الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين أبو القاسم محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين. Brothers, sisters, respected scholars and elders, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. For the return of our Imam, please recite a loud salawat. And if you're having fun, recite a loud salawat. Sorry, I couldn't hear you. Okay, I could hear that one. I could definitely hear some loud noise coming from the lads down in front. Let me begin by extending my heartfelt congratulations to you, to all Muslims, and to all mankind on this auspicious occasion of the birth of our beloved Prophet Muhammad al-Mustafa sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam. And I cannot stress how important it is at this time, when there are so many people out there doing their utmost to defame our Prophet, to tarnish his image, and to present a false image of him to the world. I cannot tell you how important it is and how wonderful it is to see so many people here gathered to remember him and remember his legacy. Salawat. And in the events of the last week, this takes on a special significance, especially the events in Paris, which now occupy headlines around the world. But I can only conclude that the terrorists who carried out these attacks in Paris had a very well-developed sense of irony. Because although they claim to be attacking these cartoonists for making disrespectful caricatures of the Prophet, I can think of all the offensive caricatures I have seen of our beloved Prophet, I can think of none more insulting to him than these extremists who claim to act in his name. They do more damage to the image and the legacy of our Prophet than any cartoon ever could. But whenever something like this happens, especially in the West, there are people who say that Islam has a problem with extremism. And they're right, but not in the way they think. Because if Islam has a problem with extremism, it is because the main victims of this extremism are the Muslims themselves. You know, someone years ago told me a funny story. It's 2003, it's the run-up to the Iraq War, and George Bush and Tony Blair, remember them? They were getting together to finalize their plans, so they go to a restaurant and they're sitting and talking very seriously with one another. And the waiter comes up to them and, seeing the expression on their faces, he says, "Gentlemen, is everything all right? Is there something wrong with the food?" And Tony Blair, being the affable fellow he is, says, no, the food's fine. We're kind of planning World War III here." And the waiter goes, "Oh, well, what are you going to do?" And Tony says, "Well, we're going to kill about 1 million Iraqis and one bicycle repairman." At which point, the waiter looks confused. He says, "Why are you going to kill a bicycle repairman?" So George Bush leans in with a smile on his face and he says, "You see, Tony, I told you no one was going to care about them Iraqis." So this week, if we really want to do a tally of the victims of extremism, we can begin by the hundreds of people killed and wounded across the Muslim world in bombings in Yemen, in Lebanon, in Pakistan. We can talk about the 2,000 people massacred when Boko Haram leveled an entire town in Nigeria. And yes, 17 people unjustly had their lives taken from them in Paris, France. And yet it is only the last of these stories which inform the narrative. Why is it, for example, that these three extremists are taken to represent Islam more than the ordinary Muslims who showed exemplary heroism in confronting them? What about the Muslim police officer, Ahmed Merebet? What about the Muslim employee at the kosher supermarket who led customers to safety? Why do they represent Islam any less than the three extremists? And why do the thousands of Muslim victims matter any less than the 17 victims who so tragically lost their lives in France? Now, there may be some people who will say, yes, but the attack on Charlie Hebdo had a symbolic significance because it was an attack on our freedom. An attack on our freedom. Wait, that sounds vaguely familiar. I seem to remember someone saying that sometime before. But I want to ask you, if this was an attack on freedom, an attack on freedom of expression, then I wonder if Charlie Hebdo had been a different kind of publication, if its staff had mainly been Muslims, and if the main cartoons they had drawn had been mocking the Holocaust, would everyone have been so quick to say, "Je suis Charlie"? I am Charlie? In fact, I find it slightly hypocritical that France is claiming to be the home of free expression, while to this day it restricts the free expression of Muslim women to express their religious identity by donning a hijab. And so I wonder if in the coming weeks, perhaps, these millions and millions of people across France who are holding pencils could also be persuaded to put headscarves on in solidarity with their fellow French citizens who are having their freedom curtailed. And in sharing these offensive cartoons on Twitter, across the internet, I cannot help but feel, I cannot help but sense an underlying hostility towards Islam. It is as if to say, do you see, O Muslims, what your excessive reverence for your prophet has done? As if Islam and Muslims everywhere are somehow to blame for the actions of a few deranged extremists and their poisonous ideology. And that's why it's little surprise when we see Rupert Murdoch, of all people, of course, a great champion of free speech and phone hacking, who tweeted, "Maybe most Muslims peaceful, but until they recognize and destroy their growing jihadist cancer, they must be held responsible." They must be held responsible. Not only must they condemn, we've condemned. Not only must they apologize, some people have apologized. They must be held responsible. I must say it's chutzpah of the highest order that a man whose media empire cheered one of the bloodiest wars in recent memory to talk to us about responsibility. But should Muslims apologize? Are Muslims responsible for this? You know, as a Muslim, I have lost count of all the things I am supposed to be condemning right at this very moment. I saw some interesting suggestions on Twitter for an app, I Condemn, which will allow us all to condemn much more quickly when an idiot who happens to be a Muslim does something terrible somewhere in the world. But I wonder why it is, if we are supposed to feel responsible, if we are always supposed to condemn, which we do, which we have, why it is that no one feels the need to demand that Christians condemn the invasion of Iraq, the Lord's Resistance Army of Uganda, or Anders Breivik. Did George Bush not say God told him to invade Iraq? Does the Lord's Resistance Army in Uganda that uses child soldiers not say it is acting to restore the Ten Commandments? Did Anders Breivik, before he went and killed 77 innocent people in Norway in 2011, did he not call himself a Christian soldier and a protector of Judeo-Christian civilization? Now, of course, in the case of George Bush, we know that when he said God told him to, it was Dick Cheney dressed in a white sheet. But the fact remains. So no, I am not Charlie. I am Ahmed Merabet. I am the victims of Boko Haram. I am the victims of Daesh. Because I am a follower of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi. But at the same time, we as Muslims do have a special duty to confront extremism. We have a special responsibility to confront extremism. Because whether we like it or not, these men are acting in the name of our Prophet. And it is a Muslim's duty to defend the honor of the Prophet. And these people are killing our Muslim brothers and sisters around the world. And so, yes, we have a duty to confront this extremism. Extremism is possibly one of the greatest threats to Islam today. But this is not only the visible extremism, the extremism of Al-Qaeda, of Daesh, of the Taliban, of Boko Haram, and the others who follow this ideology. There is another kind of extremism, a subtle kind, a hidden, creeping, insidious kind of extremism, sectarianism, that is spreading throughout the Muslim world. If you ask me, the real cancer that we have to cut out is this. Because whenever events like this happen, you hear people saying things on both sides. You hear people saying, sometimes in a whisper, sometimes in private gatherings, occasionally from the podium, they say that our Sunni brothers and sisters are the problem. They say that Daesh is a Sunni phenomenon. That there is something particular to Sunni Islam that produces such people. And they think that they're being daring and radical and brave and telling us some hard truths that we need to understand. And they go so far as to suggest, only suggest, that perhaps we should not stand with certain groups of oppressed people because they don't like us very much. But even if that were true, which it isn't, this is not bravery, this is moral cowardice. Because it is exactly the same logic that racists use today, that when a mosque is attacked, when a Muslim woman is attacked in the street, they say, no, this is a natural reaction. People are upset with Muslims because they're all terrorists. And by the way, a racist won't stop to ask you if you're Shia or Sunni before he punches you in the gut. This is the same logic the racists use. It is the same logic that Daesh uses. And if we give in to this logic of sectarianism, of division, of harboring prejudices about other Muslims because they subscribe to a slightly different set of beliefs to ours, then the extremists have won because we have become just like them. Now, if you want to see bravery, real bravery, I invite you to look at Sayyid Ali Sistani. May Allah protect him. Because he is living in Iraq. He is living on the front lines. There is literally an army out there that if they could, they would kill him. And what does he say? What does he say to the language of hatred, of suspicion, of sectarianism? He says, do not call the Sunnis our brothers, ikhwanina. Call them ourselves, anfusana, salawat. And if we want to confront this extremism, we must go back to the seerah of the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi. The Prophet whom Allah tabarak wa ta'ala describes in the Quran, saying, we did not send you illa rahmatan lil alameen, except as a mercy to the worlds. To the worlds. And we know that Allah's mercy, in the Quran we are told, it encompasses all things. Allah's mercy is universal. It does not discriminate. It is there for everyone. The name Ar-Rahman means the one whose mercy is limitless. There is nothing. There is not an atom outside this mercy. It is universal. And if we are followers of our beloved Prophet, if we are truly following his teachings, then we too, as believers, have to try and embody this universal rahmah. And part of embodying that universal rahmah means that we need to stand with the oppressed, wherever they are and whoever they are. And it means that we have to stand together as Muslims, as people who believe in justice, as human beings, and not allow the oppressors to divide us from one another. Because we are one ummah with one message. It is time that we were one fist raised against oppression. But words are not enough. It is not enough for us to talk about combating extremism. It is not enough for us to tell nice stories about the Prophet. It is not enough for us to go on TV, to go on radio, to plead, to beg, to say, no, these people don't represent us. These are words. But in the Quran, Allah tabarak wa ta'ala says that Rasulullah is uswatun hasana. He is an exemplary example for us to follow. And that he has khuluqin azim, he has a great character. So we must do more than talk about the Prophet and tell stories about the Prophet. We must become more like the Prophet. We must learn more about the Prophet's life. When Imam Ali alayhi salam sent Ibn Abbas to negotiate with the Khawarij, the extremists of his day at Nahrawan, Ibn Abbas said, Ya Amir al-Mu'mineen, should I dispute with them according to the Quran? And Imam Ali says, no, because the Quran is open to different interpretations. Instead, dispute with them according to the Sunnah of the Prophet. We as Muslims, whether Sunni or Shia, are all united by our love for Rasulullah. We are all united in that we all claim to follow Rasulullah. And it is truly a tragedy that it has taken an event such as this for Muslims to finally start showing concern for the life of Rasulullah. There was silence, then there was this shooting, and suddenly all over the internet people are quoting examples from the Prophet's life. The tragedy here isn't that they were quoting these examples. It's that until this happened, they weren't interested in it. They only turned to Rasulullah to draw lessons from Rasulullah in order to refute the extremists. And speaking as a Shia, this is especially to my Shia brothers and sisters, there are times when we talk about the Prophet, when we look at the Prophet's life, and sadly, it seems as though the Prophet could be a supporting character in his own story. We only talk about him when it comes to the hadith of Ghadir, to the hadith of Thaqalain, to the event of Mubahala. What about everything else? And so if we want to fight the extremists who claim to act in the name of our Prophet, we must first reclaim our Prophet from those extremists. And we can only do this if we imbibe the prophetic virtues, if we imbibe the prophetic characteristics, and we apply them in our own lives. I would like to finish by reading you a quote. When Anders Breivik went on his rampage in Norway, one of the survivors was interviewed by CNN. And this young girl, she said something so beautiful. She said, "If one man can show so much hate, think how much love we could show standing together." And so on this occasion, at a time when there are forces out there doing everything they can to divide us and keep us apart, I invite all of you to think what we could achieve if only we stood together. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Please recite a salawat.